The title of this course, Objectivism, State of the Art, may be misleading. It has nothing to do with aesthetics, nor with the cultural acceptance of objectivism. It's a catchy way of saying the latest, most up-to-date formulations of objectivism that I have reached. Or as I put it in the description, what I personally learned about objectivism while writing my current book. The book, of course, is called Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand, and will be out, I expect, about 2 years from now, actually available at the bookstores. This book was supposed to be an edited version of a course that I gave in 1976. I always said that you learn much more writing than you do from oral delivery, and I have proved that in spades by the experience of editing this 1976 course. I've been editing it in quotes for 3 years now, and I'm only two-thirds of the way through, but many points have become more clear to me in the last few years than were earlier, and this after 30 years of one-on-one study with Ayn Rand. Not all of these points, by the way, are in the book itself. I'm trying to confine myself in this book only to points that I know 100% certainty Ayn Rand would agree with, since I'm presenting this as her philosophy. Further elaborations and developments that I never had a chance to think of or talk to with her while she was alive are being postponed to a subsequent book. But for this course, I'm not making that distinction. I want to more or less take you behind the scenes of some of the problems and confusions I myself had, and then the answers that I came to. Now, by the very definition of the topic, this is inherently an advanced presentation. It's a graduate course. And the prerequisites is everything. That is, all the material I've covered in previous courses and all of Ayn Rand's books. I'm building on that material and taking it for granted. So I must say at the outset, frankly, that if you are a beginner, as I understand some people are, you're going to have a lot of trouble with my classes. I will try, for the sake of those who are newcomers, to sketch in a lightning-like fashion, the meaning of the various theories and ideas that I'm taking for granted. But it will be so fast as to be really an exercise in futility if this is your first exposure. By the nature of the kinds of topics we're going to be discussing, there is a certain motivational problem in giving this course. If you know my past work, you know that I attach great importance to motivation, and I think it's a mistake ever to lecture an audience at length without first convincing them of the personal importance to them of the material, without motivating them so that they're salivating to grasp the information. But the problem with this kind of advanced course is, why would anyone who is not a professional philosopher want to know this sort of detail, the kind of things I didn't learn in my first 30 years, in effect. Now, Ayn Rand used to distinguish philosophy for Reardon from philosophy for Ragnar. Now, philosophy for Reardon was philosophy as required for a rational, intelligent, but non-professional intellectual. Whereas Ragnar Danneskiold was, of course, a professional philosopher. Presumably, most of you fall in the Reardon rather than the Ragnar side of this distinction by the nature of your profession. So what can I say to motivate you? The best I can say is that I do actually believe that if you persist in pursuing the kinds of topics we're going to be discussing, it will help even non-philosophers. Help in making the ideas you accept clearer to you, and above all, help you in your ability to prove those conclusions. Therefore, it will make your ideas even more solid and convincing to you. you know what proof is according to objectivism? It's reduction to the perceptual level, and that's something we're going to be discussing in more detail later. The whole concept of proof, the attempt of it, is to take some abstract, esoteric idea and bring it back step by step to reality to make it as far as possible like a percept, a direct sensory observation. All concepts, as presumably you know, are ways of integrating or holding in a single mental unit, percepts, observations, and the most highfalutin or abstract theory is simply a way of condensing observations. So that what you do when you prove something is take it back step by step until you finally can point and say, this is the source in reality. Now, all the technicalities that we are going to be discussing are really aimed at this purpose. They're to help us get to the stage where, when you hear an objectivist idea, however abstract, your mind immediately, directly sees its roots step by step going back to direct observation. You should be able, if we're successful and if you pursue this on your own, to have a sort of a perceptual feeling in connection with any abstract idea. That is, the sense that it has the status and reality in your mind of a direct observation. Of course, it isn't an observation. It's a high inference from observation. But nevertheless, if you have connected it back through the necessary intermediate links, it should stand in your mind as, I'm directly looking at reality when I advocate this idea. It's obvious it should have that feeling to you, as opposed to being a floating abstraction. Now, many people have this with mathematical ideas, or at least with elementary mathematical ideas. If they consider 2 and 2 equals 4, that seems obvious to them, and if someone at a party said 2 and 2 is 5, they may have many emotional reactions, but they wouldn't feel threatened by that. They'd think, this guy is peculiar. What could be the explanation? But when you take abstract philosophic ideas, such as capitalism is the moral ideal, or every man should have an unbreached integrity, or selfishness is a virtue, if they hear that challenged at a party, they feel threatened. Well, there's many reasons for that, but one reason is it doesn't stand in their mind as being as blatantly, obviously true as 2 and 2 equals 4. The kind of exercises we're going to be engaged in should work toward that end, to help bring it back to the direct obvious. That, of course, you'll still have the problem of the people who don't know anything about reality, but it won't be that much of a threat to you yourself. Now, to gain this kind of knowledge of philosophy takes time and detail. You have to be familiar with the process a step at a time. There's a lot of nitty-gritty, a lot of difficult questions that are not on the face of it obvious. It's not as though with every point I make you're going to say, and now I finally get philosophy. There's a cumulative, gradual process. Hopefully, as we go along, things will become clearer and clearer. And I will try to supplement this general motivation by more particular motivations as we proceed. But that is it for my general attempt to motivate you. I've divided the 6 periods of this course into 3 overall topics, and then miscellaneous at the end if there's time. The first and most important, which I'm going to start this morning, is the structure of objectivism, the logical structure of objectivism, concentrating on the basic branches of philosophy, metaphysics, and epistemology, and perhaps just touching on ethics. By the way, I'm not going to be referring to politics or aesthetics at all in this course, because they take care of themselves if you know the foundations. By the structure of objectivism, I mean the order, the logical hierarchy. What depends on what? And in the process of discussing this, we will lay out the central principles of objectivism in logical order. And the most important thing is for you to see the reasons for the order. In other words, this is not, we are not here concerned with a purely pedagogical presentation, convenience of presentation. That would be unimportant. That would be of use only to people who want to write a textbook or teach it to beginners. We are concerned with the order of logical dependence. What logically comes first? What is the precondition to the next? What does that lead to? And so on. And this particular kind of structure is essential to proof. Because proof, I said, is reducing something back to reality. You must grasp the logical structure connecting one idea to the next, if you are to be able to prove it. Once you know the structure, you know the method of proof of every key idea, because you know the steps that connect it back to reality. You know the chain. You say, if you start with this idea, well, that came from this one, from this one, from this one, from this one. Oh, there's reality. And the more each link of the chain is clear to you, the more you can slide from any given one right back down, and pretty soon the relation to reality is so automatized that you have that feeling, this is direct observation. On the other hand, if you get the structure wrong, if you have one idea dependent on one that in fact it doesn't depend on, you invert the order, you make something primary when it's derivative or vice versa, then you have broken the tie to reality. You can't then go one step at a time. Your chain is cut, and then you have various forms of confusion, chaos, the thing being unconvincing. So I do believe that logical hierarchy is essential to proper learning. There are a lot of contentious issues within this subject. And philosophers of goodwill who agree with objectivism and who study this debate fiercely and at length within certain parameters whether this point precedes or succeeds a given one. I'm going to give you some indication of some of those problems, but I'm going to come out flatly for my own views on this. And when we discuss the general issue of structure, to illustrate this as still part of the first unit, I'm going to take the objectivist metaphysics and actually work it out one step at a time, from the very first of the first axioms to the very last of the last consequences, to show you as a model how you would take it and where everything fits and why you couldn't change the order. And then at the end, when you start at any point, why you go all the way back down that chain to the beginning. I found this very illuminating when I started to present the part on objectivist metaphysics, that I didn't really know what order certain things went in, or even try to figure out what order they went in. And then finally, that was clarified for me in a process of long, complex thinking about it, and I hope you will find that of interest. That's our whole first unit, structure, with then the example of metaphysics. And then the second unit is a crucial topic in epistemology, objectivity. You know, in the sense in which we contrast the objective with the intrinsic and the subjective, and the implications that I have seen in it that are new to me. And that involves tying objectivity to logic in a way that I think is new and makes clearer Ayn Rand's originality in regard to logic. In what sense she did something revolutionary in regard to logic that I never fully appreciated while she was alive. And that's going to occupy us in the second unit. And then the third unit and the last of our formal presentation is going to be on ethics, with a stress on the role of moral principles in human life. This, to me, in my writing, was the biggest news. Of course, I knew that moral principles were desirable, but there was a lot of things that I learned that became tremendously clear when they were tied into the issue of moral principles. Just to pique your curiosity, I have a lengthy discussion of each of the seven virtues in my book that objectivism recognizes. You know, rationality, independence, integrity, honesty, justice, productiveness, pride. And I expected I would sail through those relative to metaphysics and epistemology, which are so much more difficult. And one of those virtues proved to be harder than any other part of the book. And what really amazed me, the complexities and confusions, and the integrations that were required to grasp it, I would never have predicted in advance, and it's now, in my opinion, one of the very best parts of the book. You have to forgive me for boasting, but... could you guess offhand which of the seven virtues was unexpectedly, to me at least, proved to be the hardest? No, not pride. Pride was easy. No, not honesty. Honesty was the second hardest. Justice was the third hardest. No, it was integrity. It was integrity. When I finished that, I finally understood entirely why Ayn Rand made integrity the theme of The Fountainhead. Out of all the possible virtues, why she picked that as, well, of course, integrity with independence as the theme, because I saw the centrality of that to ethics in a way that I hadn't seen before. This is to motivate you. In case you fall asleep this week, that's next week. Now, if after these we have any time in our six periods, my miscellaneous addendum, and it depends how many questions you have, you know, how much back and forth there is to take at random certain statements of Miss Rand or quotes or ideas of hers that at one time I thought I understood, that I subsequently saw that I didn't and that I now really do, and ask you what you see in them and then tell you what I have discovered. This last is sort of a grab bag of points, but whether we get to that depends on how long we spend on the other. Now, just one other preliminary, and that is, in addition to the six sessions, we have two additional all-purpose question periods. And I'm going to divide it up this way. Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday of each week is going to be the regular sessions. Saturday will be the all-purpose miscellaneous question period, each Saturday. So try to confine your questions during the classes on Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday to the materials that we discuss then. And anything farther ranging or about objectivism in general, save for Saturday. If you want to be sure of having your question answered on Saturday, I would advise you to write it out, simply because by past experience there are so many hundreds of written questions submitted that just winnowing through them and selecting cuts out the possibility of taking live questions, although I try to take one or two. But I would prefer, for ease of sorting, if you know by now that at 1:30 on Saturday there's going to be an all-purpose, free-for-all question period, it must be able to occur to you between now and Thursday, say, what question you would want. If you could write it out briefly and hand it in, there should be a box, and maybe Don Lamont will get a box or something we can put them in tomorrow so that I can go through them. There are no restrictions whatever on written questions. You can ask personal questions. I don't have to answer them, but you can ask whatever you want, and then I'll pick through whatever I think is of most general interest. The only restriction is, if the question is written out at great length, I may not have time to read it. So I can't read a book, for instance, followed by, is this true, yes or no? It has to be condensed in some reasonable way. All right, now I want to start with the hierarchical structure of objectivism. You can write that down if you're writing a title. Now let me make the problem here clear before I give you the answer. We start to philosophize as adults, at which point we already have a tremendous number of complex philosophic conclusions that we assume, accept, and have automatized as part of our mental equipment. And all of these conclusions form a system, an integration, every element of which is crucial to the rest. To put the point another way, philosophy as we encounter it as adults is a totality. It's a complete system, and no one point will stand without the rest. If you know the aphorism of Hegel, which is one of the few things he said which is profound, which I love to quote, the true is the whole, W-H-O-L-E. And that is absolutely applicable to philosophy. It's a total system, every point of which interconnects with every other point. Let's take an example. Take a point from metaphysics. Now, for beginners, metaphysics is the subject which studies the nature of the universe as a whole. And one of the points in metaphysics that objectivism subscribes to is the law of cause and effect, which roughly says every event has a cause, the world is orderly, under certain conditions the same thing will act the same way, and this is the basis, one of the bases of science, the law of cause and effect. Consider that for a moment, or consider a point from ethics. Now, one of the key objectivist virtues is the virtue of rationality, which, again, for beginners, is the view that you should use your mind, you should think, you should try to understand, and you should live by the guidance of reason. That's a point from metaphysics and a point from ethics. Could either of these, we're taking this just as an example of the interdependence of philosophy, could either of these points stand without the point from epistemology that the senses are valid? Epistemology, by the way, is the theory of knowledge. What processes do we have to go through to acquire and validate knowledge? And one key tenet of epistemology, of the objectivist epistemology, is the senses are unqualifiedly valid. They are reliable. We can trust the data they give us. But now I'm saying, take those three ideas. Could the law of cause and effect, or the virtue of rationality, could either one stand apart from the issue of the validity of the senses? Now, if you think about it, you will see, obviously, they could not. The senses are our basic means of knowledge. If the senses are unreliable, so is everything built on them. Everything, therefore, is wiped out, including any conclusions we come to about reality, such as cause and effect, or any conclusions we come to about ethics, such as that you should be rational. Well, could either of these ideas, causality or rationality, stand without concepts being valid? Concepts, you know, abstract words that we use to integrate sense data. And of course, it's central to objectivism that concepts are valid, that they keep us in contact with reality, that they're forms of cognition of reality and not some kind of social delusion or supernatural revelation. Could the law of cause and effect be upheld if you didn't believe that concepts were valid? Obviously not. The law of cause and effect is formulated in terms of concepts. So is the virtue of rationality. The word rationality itself is a concept. So both those ideas and every other idea presupposes the validity of concept. So it looks like, obviously then, the senses come first, right? Because everything rests on them, and concepts have to come first. So if you look at it from that point of view, you'd say, well, it's obvious where you start. But let's look at it in the other direction. Could you start with the validity of the senses without relying on cause and effect? Suppose you said, I agree with David Hume that there is no cause and effect. Everything is just a miracle, but that's a different question. At least I can trust my senses. Well, how would you go about validating the senses? Hume would say, well, it's just a series of inexplicable data. It has no tie to any outside factor, any outside entity operating upon you, any external cause. The full validation of the senses obviously requires cause and effect. If there is no cause and effect, there's absolutely no basis to tie your immediate data to anything external to you. So, you see, you need one to get the other and the other to get the one, and you have to have them all at the same time. To put it in more general terms, the problem. Metaphysics seems obviously necessary to justify epistemology. You have to know what kind of world you're living in to know how to acquire knowledge about it. On the other hand, obviously the reverse must be true. If you don't have a reliable method, how do you come to conclusions about the nature of reality? This is the problem of seeming circularity. And this is a problem in one way or another everybody has in philosophy until they straighten it out. It's sometimes called the problem of I can't get started. Because everything depends on everything else, and wherever I start, right away I had to assume something else, and as soon as I go to that, I needed the first thing. There's therefore a very crucial sense in which philosophy is a total. It stands or falls as a total. And you simply cannot, in that sense, find a beginning or an end, because the whole thing is a completely integrated total. And yet, despite this, obviously, we must and have to break philosophy up into parts, into principles, into elements, which develop in a certain order. If we couldn't do that, there would be no such thing as proof. There would be no such thing as how did you ever learn a philosophy, because you don't just inject it into the brain of an infant in the crib. So in some sense, there has to be a logical sequence, a development, a structure, where something is absolutely first, and then second, and then third, even though the whole thing is one totality and requires being accepted as a totality. Now you see what the problem, this is the problem that is very vexing, particularly if you're writing a book and you have to have the exact structure correct. Because every time you write a sequence, you think, no, the next sequence had to come first, but you can't do that. Now, it's not just a problem, as I indicated by using the virtue of rationality, only between metaphysics and epistemology. Sometimes people think, well, it's just because those two branches are interconnected. That's not true. It involves the whole of philosophy, and it involves ethics too. For instance, in discussing any issue as adults, we're not only counting on a certain view of reality and a certain method of understanding, but we're counting on the fact that it is proper for us to practice that method. It's good for us to try to understand, to think, to use our minds. And once we say good, we are deep in the thickets of ethics, value theory, morality. You have to, in other words, already accept a whole code of values in order to undertake this task of understanding something. Whereas if you agreed with Augustine or Jerry Falwell or the White House, you would say you should accept things on faith blindly. It's bad to try to understand, and so on. In other words, you need the moral sanction. You need the moral right to use your mind. You need the righteousness to pursue your own selfish understanding, even if other people don't like it. You need the obligation and the right to preserve your own intellectual independence. You need a whole ethics, basically, of life and reason to justify and validate the pursuit of rational truth. So it seems that ethics also was a requirement of any process of rational cognition. Yet, obviously, you ask, well, how would you justify an ethics? It has to be, many things have to come way before ethics. So again, we come to the point, as just another example of the point. Everything depends on everything, but you have to start somewhere. Now, the problem with people that don't worry on this issue is that they hold philosophy simply as a total. They can't break it up into its structure, into its elements, and consequently they feel lost. When they try to prove any one thing, they just chase their tail, and they go to other things and back to the first thing, and they throw up their hands in despair. Now that's the problem, basically, which we're trying to solve by discussing the hierarchical structure. And the first thing we have to understand is, how can there be a structure since everything is part of this single total? Well, We have to make a distinction, a very crucial distinction here, between what is true of us as adults versus what we had to do to get to that point. As adults, it is true. Philosophy is a total. Every element literally does depend on every other, and any change in any one would wipe out all the rest. And therefore, it's true that as adults, we have to assume and presuppose everything about a philosophy when we discuss any one of its points. But here's the distinction. And that doesn't affect the fact that philosophy has a definite logical structure, because we did not and could not learn philosophy as one total. We aren't born tabula rasa, and then someone gives you an injection of a pill and you gulp it down and you know the total. We learn in stages, in definite stages, and we had to learn in stages, starting from the points which are directly accessible in reality, and then going to the next one. So the first thing that I would write down, everything I've set up to now, you didn't have to write down. The first thing I would write down is this. There is a logical necessity in the order of learning philosophy. There is a logical necessity in the order of learning. Even though when you have learned the total, everything depends on everything. Now I'm going to elaborate this theory and so on, but I want to give you an example here so it's not too abstract. Let's take the very example that we mentioned, namely causality and the senses. The law of cause and effect, reality is orderly and lawful and so on. And the issue of the senses are valid, seeing is believing, we can trust our eyes and ears. Now I indicated to you that these two are completely interdependent. But in the order of learning, I want you to think, one of them far preceded the other. One of them had in logic to be learned much before the other. We're speaking now of as a young child grows up and develops. Now I want to see by a show of hands, commit yourself now, I won't ask you to explain, but just out of curiosity. If you had to choose, how many would say, and I granted the child, we're talking about him learning it in an implicit form. I mean, he may have to be many years older before he can articulate the adult statement of these, but in terms of the substance, which do you think a child learns first and has to? Now, those who would say cause and effect, let's see by a show of hands. And those who would say the validity of the senses. Well, that's fascinating because the majority of you took the validity of the senses. And that's fascinating to me because that is wrong. So that means you have something to learn about hierarchical structure. A child must grasp causality first, far before the validity of the senses. He has to, now I'm giving you this just as an example, later we'll do it all more systematically. He has to look out and grasp reality way before he could possibly introspect and grasp his means of knowledge. First, you must have a content in your consciousness, something you know. Only then, even in a primitive way, can you address the question of how did I get to know? Content has to precede method. Or put it another way, first there must be an object of consciousness before you can grasp the fact or any processes of consciousness. First you have to be conscious of something. Only then are you able, even in a childish, implicit way, to look in and say, oh yeah, I'm doing something to get this information. To put it still one other way, the outer must precede the inner. And it's not an accident, therefore, that Greek philosophy had 100 years or more at the beginning of exclusive focus on metaphysics before it occurred to someone to say, well, how do we know that this is true? And then it was actually the sophists that started epistemology. But metaphysics, or the outer must precede the inner. Now, causality, just to continue our example, is central to grasping clearly the outer, to grasping reality clearly. Because until a child would grasp order, regularity, predictability, some kind of lawful realm, until that point, he has no grasp of a firm, dealable with world. He merely has a chaos of fleeting impressions. And in that primitive a state of consciousness, it's impossible to introspect. It's impossible to abstract and say, I'm going to set aside this world and focus just on my means of knowing. You don't have a world yet. Before you have any, the most rudimentary grasp of order, or predictability, regularity, you have no grasp of a world, just of chaos, what William James called a blooming, buzzing confusion. And in that state, you cannot say, I'm going to set aside the object of my awareness and focus on how I do it. It's just, I mean, you're even beneath a freshman at that point. Now, the confirmation of this is, if you look empirically at child development, children grasp causality very, very close to the beginning. I'd hesitate to give you an exact date, but they grasp it in the very earliest months. They grasp causal efficacy in primitive terms, but enough so that implicitly they get the idea. For instance, one of the earliest things they do is drop objects and see that the thing falls and makes a noise. And that delights them. And of course, for quite a while, they're like David Hume. They keep dropping it. No, because they don't know that it's going to happen the next time. And they get a thrill each time out of the fact that they did it, that there's a piece of order, that there's a cause and effect. And of course, they do this time after time, sequence after sequence. Reaching out the hand they grasp gets them something. And then they grasp at everything, or crying, you know, will get attention, and so on and so on. They have countless instances in the very earliest period. But it's much later. It's hard for me, again, to give an exact time, because it varies from child to child, but I at least a year, I would say, from my experience with one child, before they're sophisticated enough to grasp just this much. When I close my eyes, I don't see anymore. That comes as a big revelation to a young child, that there is such a thing as eyes, and when you put your hands over them, you can't see. When you take your hand away, you see again. Now, this is a sophisticated development. This is a child coming to grasp that something he does brings him in contact with what's out there. And of course, it absolutely requires that first you have a very stable sense that there is something out there. Then this is a new causal instance that he discovers. It's a new example of cause and effect. And that is the beginning of him as an epistemologist. When he first plays peekaboo and he sees, oh, look, there's something and now it's gone, that is his start. And of course, if you know anything about children, you know that that comes much later than this elementary grasp of causal efficacy. So the point is, the child had to use his senses from the beginning. But logically, in terms of the order of his learning, in terms of the order of his grasping the issues, he had to grasp causality first before he could even begin to approach the fact that he has senses, that they bring him in contact with reality, etc. Now, there's an example of two issues that are completely interdependent as adults, and yet there was a definite sequence, and there had to be that sequence in the learning of those issues. Now, let me bring in what we call the spiral theory of learning, which is a key objectivist point and is essential for you to grasp this material. How many of you do not know the spiral theory? Okay, well, may I just ask, of those same people, how many of you are totally lost at this point anyway? Well, that's hopeful. The spiral theory was Ayn Rand's point that knowledge New knowledge is not acquired in a straight sequential series. New piece, then another one, then another one, then another one forever. Her view of knowledge, if I dare walk with all these wires on me, was like this. You learn the first point here directly in contact with reality. Then you go on and learn another point. Then you realize that that point connects to the first point and that there's more to be learned about this first point. So you come back to it again and now you see it in a fuller context. Then you go on to your third point, let's say, and you realize, oh, that now makes this one clearer, and now I see this one even clearer. So knowledge is forward and back, and it goes onward in the form of a continuous ascending spiral, as opposed to the idea that you learn, and then you just simply build like this with never a glance back. Now, this is very essential, this spiral theory, to understanding what happens to ideas in our mind and to grasping logical structure. Because, let's continue the example of the senses and causality. Let's take this child, he grasps causality, and then let's say substantially later, in some way he grasps the issue of the senses, and let's even take him to the point, just for purposes of example, where he knows the word senses and all that. Well, he then grasps the senses react to stimuli that impinge on him, that they produce effects from certain causes. So, he understands the senses through causality. Causality was earlier to him, and now using that, he's able to grasp how the senses operate. This, in turn, gives him a much more extensive grasp of causality because he now sees many more instances of it. And at the same time, causality enables him to validate the senses because if someone now says, why do you trust your eyes? He says, well, look, that thing out there acted on me, assuming we give him a little help. In other words, now he's got the basis for answering David Hume in a way that I indicated to you earlier. And if then someone says to him, well, I don't believe in causality, he says, oh yes, look and see. You can see that things are orderly. In other words, he's using his senses to validate causality as earlier he used causality to explain the senses to him. Now this is a continuous back and forth. And I'm giving you just two elements here. And the pattern is this. He learned causality first. Then, much later, he learned the senses. Then he went back to causality to see the wider role that it plays, because he didn't know that many instances of it. And then he uses the senses that he's discovered to validate causality and causality to explain the senses. So at this point, after he's made all of these spirals around and around, it stands in his mind as one interconnected total. He got to a new element. He went back to see the effects on the earlier. He now sees the earlier wouldn't stand without the later or the later without the earlier. He makes a new integration. And if you attack either one, he sees it now as one total. And if you said to him now as an adult, well, which comes first? You say, well, you have to have both. You can't have law without trusting your senses, and you can't have your senses if there is no law. And to him, it's now one total. And that is a tribute to the cognitive spiraling that he has consistently gone through. The point is, there is a structure, and there is an order, a logically necessary order, and the only way to prove is to grasp that order. But we blur that order deliberately as we are developing because we spiral. And we have to spiral and go back and forth and interconnect. And therefore, basically, what we have to do to grasp the logical structure and therefore the means of objective proof is to break down what we have spiraled into a totality. We have to go back and retrace the key steps that we had to begin as children until we come to the end. Once we have that, we can take any point and go straight back without getting trapped in the adult spiral. Now, I don't want you to think that that spiral is bad. If you didn't have that, you'd be completely lost. You wouldn't have any connection between anything. You'd have no integration, and your knowledge would be of no use to you. So I'll give it to you. Does it help to give it to you in letters rather than words? Like if you have A, B, C, D, E. You must know that order. You must know that A comes before B, comes before C. But then you make so many interconnections that you finally can see it only as A, B, C, D, E, or A, D, C, B, or B, D, C, A. Any combination will strike you as good as any other because they all are completely interconnected. But then what you have to do is say, of all of these, which must have been the A and the B and the so on? And then when you have that, if there's any question about any one, if you really have done all the key steps, you simply look at D, for instance, and say, well, that comes right from C, from B, from A, and oh, there's reality. And once you slide right back down that, you have it tied directly to reality. Now, in case you think that this sounds excessively complicated, let me just say as an aside that this is true of any field in which there is integration, which means of any field. It's not unique to philosophy. Take mathematics, for instance. Euclidean geometry is a completely interconnected system. If you took any Euclidean theorem anywhere throughout the whole length and breadth of it and say, I'm not going to accept this, but I'll accept all the rest, of course, the whole thing would collapse entirely. So, if you didn't have Euclid or someone who had discovered a logical structure, but you had just empirically various theorems, you would have no sense of, well, how to prove anything. It would all just be this one and this one and this one all interdepend, and where do we go from here? And of course, it took a genius such as Euclid to say, this is what you start. This is the direct tie to reality, and then organize it thereafter. Well, that's what we need to do in philosophy. All right, now I want to work out the basic structure of objectivism. You understand now what I mean by structure. The genetic, logical structure of learning it. Always remembering that no one point will finally stand until we have the total. But I'm not going to keep repeating that. I'll repeat it maybe another 30 times, but not an infinite number of times. The issue before us is, what must we learn in order to get to the next point? That's the chain we want to discover. Now, I want to start by giving you a bad structure. Not really a terrible one, but a sort of middle-of-the-road, inadequate structure for laying out the objectivist ideas. And as a matter of convenience, I'm going to use the very structure that I used in 1976 in the course that I offered on philosophy of objectivism. At the time, of course, I thought this structure was fine. But I have discovered in the normal process of putting things in writing that there are grave structural flaws. The content is okay if you're still taking the course, but the order leaves a lot to be desired strictly in terms of hierarchical structure. So I want to just remind you of what the structure was, and then you can see by contrast the way I've structured the material now. That to me is certainly, without doubt, the most important thing I learned in writing this book is what order the material goes. And that, as I repeat, is not simply pedagogical or expositional. That is a logical point. This, in essence, was my original structure. I'm taking just the first six lectures because I'll confine myself here to just metaphysics and epistemology right now. Lecture one was man. And the nature of man, man's essential nature. I started with that for many reasons. Partly it was a come on, you know, because I wanted it to be popular, and I knew that people are more interested in man than in reality and knowledge, which are more abstract. So I explained that much in the lecture, that this was, whether we were starting in the middle, so that was not entirely a mistake. But I had other reasons for wanting to start with man in addition. And that was, I felt it very, very important to get in certain key things, such as the relation of theory and practice, or generally the relation of mind and body, which I covered under the nature of man, because I felt as long as people think, well, it's all theory, but it doesn't work in practice, they won't be motivated. So I felt it's very important to get theory and practice in the opening. I also felt it's very important to cover the issue of emotions at the opening, because after all, one of the most distinctive things about objectivism is emotions are not tools of cognition, etc. And if I'm taking a new audience, I've got to hit them with the idea, you know, of reason versus emotion. And so I had a whole thing about reason as man's means of knowledge and not emotions. And I had several other things, but those were some of the considerations as to why I wanted to start with man. Now then, I went to my second lecture, which was basically metaphysics or reality. I'll leave that for now. It was my second year. My third I can best describe as miscellaneous epistemology. That was the only title you could give it, because it covered the senses, reason versus mysticism, objectivity, logic, and half of free will. Half because I ran out of time. I couldn't, you know, get it all in that half. Now, I think you see why I felt, well, I have to get this stuff in at the outset. For instance, I have to get in reason versus mysticism under epistemology, because if we don't establish it, we're following reason, how can we go any further? Or I have to at least say something about objectivity, because I'm requiring the audience to be objective. Or I have to say something about logic, because I'm using logic. Or I'm relying on their power of choice, so I have to start free will at least, even if I haven't got time to finish it. In other words, I had that very strong feeling in this lecture, I can't get started. Whatever I say, I have to say something else, so I'll hit the high spots. I'll stick in about, you know, four or five absolutely urgent topics and continuously say, of course I'll come back to this later, you see. That's the best I could do at that stage of the game. Now then, I went to one on concept formation. That happily was very well organized, because I took that straight out of Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. Then I went back to, the best way to describe it would be applications of concept formation. And I covered things like knowledge as contextual, logic as knowledge as hierarchical, and so on. And then I had an all-purpose lecture that's best described as polemics. And that was mopping up whatever I hadn't got to in metaphysics and epistemology by that time. There was a big discussion of what's wrong with skepticism, and what's wrong with agnosticism, why we can be certain, and so on. And that was then the foundation that we went on. Now, of course, all these points are correct, but I want to indicate to you, by contrast, how are we doing for time? Oh, we have a couple of minutes. How the first six chapters of my book, which is an, quote, edited version of this course, relate to this presentation. Because to me, it is extremely clarifying. What do you think is number one? It happens to be one of the words up there, but it's not, which?
Reality.
Reality, absolutely. Absolutely. That is chapter one. Maybe I'll just put them on the board as they presently stand, and then I'll explain them. But do you have any idea what comes next? You couldn't, because, well, epistemology is too big. Everything else is epistemology. But I had to break it up into units. There's something which I call the anteroom of epistemology. And I will indicate that to you in a moment. Then I have a chapter on concept formation. Then a chapter, and I say this is not just, I have to reiterate that. The interest of this is not that I happened to write my book that way, that would be boring biography. There's a logic, I'm trying to say this is a logical necessity to follow the structure. Then, and only then, comes objectivity. That's the title of the chapter. And then, can you guess what one single word represents the finale of the abstract part of the book? The end of the basic philosophy. Reason. That comes at the end rather than at the beginning, the way I had it. And then comes man, and then comes ethics and politics. So it's radically different, and now what I want to do is indicate to you what was the rationale for this overall structure, because when I worked it out, to me, it made the whole thing very much clearer. First of all, a definite conviction that metaphysics precedes epistemology. Basically, I've covered the argument there in our discussion of why causality had to precede the issue of the validity of the senses. Existence comes before consciousness. Extrospection, in terms of your grasp, extrospection has to precede introspection. Epistemology is comparatively late and sophisticated. First, you have to gain lots of knowledge about the world. Only then can you look in and abstract away the content and focus on your method. In other words, first you have to have a firm grasp of reality. Then what happens is, on that basis, you pursue concrete information in many fields. You come to observations and conclusions about people, animals, cars, parks, flowers, food, etc. In the process of coming to those conclusions, you're using a certain method, you're relying on it, and at a certain point, you get sophisticated enough to turn in and say, oh, no matter what I'm looking at or thinking about, I'm using certain elements of a method. And then you can first start to turn to epistemology. So this is why reality has to be there 100% before you can even dream. Now, this is one of the 30 times. I'm reminding you that if we didn't have epistemology, nothing that we said in reality would stand. As any philosopher would say to you, well, how do you know that? You just come to conclusions about reality using your mind. How do you know your mind is valid? That is not the question we're asking. We're saying in the order of learning, what must come first? The first must come metaphysics, reality. Now, why not go directly to epistemology? Well, I have come to make a sharp division between, well, what I think of as the anteroom of epistemology versus the mansion. You know, the outer hall that leads you in and then the actual subject itself. By the anteroom, I mean those things you must know in some way even to start the subject of epistemology. Now, epistemology, as you know, is the theory of how to acquire knowledge. Why is such a subject necessary? Or put it another way, how would you ever explain to a child, assuming you had some, you know, vocabulary you could talk to him, why to even turn to this kind of question? What does it in any way depend on? Obviously, you know, as adults, epistemology advises you on the use of what? With a C. Concepts. That's really all epistemology is about. How a conceptual being should function in order to acquire knowledge. That is the only reason we need it. Dogs and cats do not need epistemology, although they need knowledge. But they don't need epistemology because they just rely on the automatic data of their senses. They can't go wrong. They have no choice. They just take what comes. We need epistemology because we can't rely on the data of our senses only. We have to process it by a certain means, and the means are not automatic. Well, that means that in order even to get into the subject, to appreciate it, we need to know two things. One, what is it that's given that we don't need advice about, and which is the base on which everything else is built? Namely, the senses, the validity of the senses. Now that is, I regard, as not properly part of epistemology. Why not? In the sense in which epistemology gives you guidance on how to use your mind. What guidance can epistemology give you with regard to the senses? Does it tell you how to open your eyes, or how many drops to put in when they hurt, or how close to get your eye to something, or when to push your finger? It has nothing to say whatever about it. It says, however you sense, good luck. We have no advice to offer. We're exactly like the animals with regard to the senses. Just go out and do it. And whatever comes to you, good. You can accept that. So this is not anything that a philosopher or that an epistemologist can offer any suggestions with regard to. It's an automatic function. And in that sense, it's a precondition or anteroom to epistemology rather than being itself a part of epistemology. I think it's important to make the distinction because we have to distinguish what is the condition versus what is the purpose of the subject. And if people go into protracted discussions of the senses, that to me is an error if they think that that is epistemology. That is simply the requirement of epistemology. First you establish the validity of the senses. But then you forget about that because that's given to you automatically. Obviously the senses have to come at the very beginning because concepts are just integrations of sensory data. So to a person who didn't grasp the data of observation that he could see, hear, and so on, could never grasp what a concept was. So within the anteroom, the data of the senses is a complete beginning. The first. Now, but there's one other precondition that I put in the anteroom before we get to epistemology, and in order to get to it, and which a child would have to grasp way early before you could even begin to teach him actual epistemology. And what is the second? I'm afraid I gave it away on the brochure. Well, free will, yeah. Free will, volition. Because there is no, the whole thing of epistemology is because it's not, our consciousness is not automatic. So first we have to establish that we do have choice, that we're in control of the exercise of our minds. And what we do when we leave the sensory realm is up to us. If you didn't have that, if a child didn't have that, he could no more begin to grasp instructions as to how to function than he could if you told him, now we're going to have a science on the proper jerk of the patellar reflex. You say, what do you mean the proper jerk? When you hit with the hammer, it jerks out. What do I have to do about it? It just happens. And as long as he's were in the state that his mind is like his knee reflex, it just happens, and it'd be entirely unintelligible to him, well, what alternative? What are you talking about? What I should do and so on. It just happens. So the child would have to reach the point, once he's grasped reality, that he has certain means of seeing, hearing, and so on, and that would be easy to tell him once he's reached certain language, and that he has a certain faculty of choice. And as you know, choice, according to objectivism, begins to operate precisely when the child begins to learn to speak, when he starts to enter the conceptual level. So that gives us there the precondition of the subject. We establish there the senses are valid, and we have volition with regard to the exercise of our mind. Well, now then, the next is straightforward. Because the first thing in logic you'd have to grasp if you're trying now to validate your knowledge is, well, what is the central thing we do with our minds? We speak, we use words. How are they related to what you see, to the sensory data? And that is the topic of concept formation. And therefore, that has to come there. That has to come. Now, concept formation is largely something about which children have no choice. In other words, they don't have to read Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology to figure out how to use the word table, chair, mother, and cloud. The brain does this, if they focus a certain way, automatically on the lower levels. But you have to learn concept formation at this stage, because until you know deliberately what concepts are, you can't then know what. What is the right method of using them in the areas where you do have choice? First, you have to know, what are these tools? How were they formed? How are they supposed to function? And then you are now free to go to the next question. And this is the first time now in Unit 4, Chapter 4, the first time we can discuss any questions of deliberate volitional method. Why is this the first time we can discuss method? Because method means method of using concepts. And first you have to have them. So it's not till way up there that you get to the central topic of method. At this point now you have an idea. I start with data. I put them together in words. But now how do I use these words? What do I do with them to acquire knowledge? What mental processes should I use to ensure that I'm using them in a way that conforms to reality? How shall I deal with concepts properly, in other words? And that is the topic of objectivity, which is a topic that is logically impossible to consider until you know what concepts are, because I say it's nothing but a means of dealing with concepts. And also, if you know the objectivist philosophy, you will know that there's no way to know what objectivity is except what? By deriving it from the very nature of concepts. I'll put that off for a couple of lectures when we get to the topic of objectivity, but the objectivist theory of objectivity is a consequence of the objectivist theory of the nature of concepts. So you couldn't possibly explain or justify or do anything with the concept of objectivity until you first knew what are concepts and how they're formed. And now, and only now, at this point, when you've covered all of this, is it logically possible to introduce reason? So in this sense, reason is the end and not the beginning. Genetically, structurally, why does it have to be the end? Well, you just ask yourself, what is reason? How would you even begin to grasp what it is? It's a faculty of using concepts to integrate data and to do it all by a certain objective method. It's a faculty whose data is the senses, whose form is concepts, and whose method is objectivity. And therefore, until you had those elements, you could never put them together. Reason is the final synthesis. It's the final union of what has been studied separately in the preceding elements. And it's only at this point, therefore, properly speaking, it's only at this point that we can now say, are emotions means of cognition or not? Only at this point. Why not sooner? I mean, if you're talking structurally now. Say it again.
Means of cognition would not be intelligible.
All right, let's use it in simpler terms. Why do I have to save the discussion that you must follow reason in order to gain knowledge and your feelings aren't infallible ties to reality? Now you know what reason is. Only at that point can you say, now in addition to this faculty, we have other aspects of consciousness. There's aspects which don't go through the senses and concepts and objectivity, but which are automatic integrations as a result of conclusions that our mind has come to. And that has to be ruthlessly separated, if we're talking about knowledge, from the parts that contribute to reason, the senses, concepts, and the method of objectivity. That, the emotional, is just an automatic byproduct. And if you develop it at that point, it becomes obvious. We've gone through all the steps of what is cognition, what are the method, what does it consist of, and now we're surveying, this is what's left in consciousness, this is how it relates to reason, and this is why it is not itself a means of knowledge. So it's at that point that you cash in on all your final epistemological conclusions. It's at that point only that you can say, now we know that we can achieve certainty. Why could we only talk about certainty at this point? You can only talk about the fruits of reason when you know what reason is. You can only talk all the polemics, what's wrong with agnosticism and what's wrong with skepticism, all of that comes at the end after we've laid out in a purely positive step-by-step fashion how you get to reason, what that concept is. And now, against all of that background, only at that point, we turn to man. And now it's just a matter of reading off, as applied to man, all of the things that we've already established in fundamental terms. In my first structure, I said man survives by reason up here. And I felt the need to give some kind of examples and try to make it plausible, because it was just out of the blue. You know, I just walk in and said, good evening, man survives by reason in this kind of thing. But now, if you go through it this way, by the time you get to man survives by reason, it has the opposite effect. It has the effect of being, that's self-evident. Why does he even bother, you know, to make a big fuss about that? We now know, surveyed the total reality of human consciousness. What else could it possibly be? So that, logically speaking, you have to wait to draw your conclusions about man until you've gone through. And the same is true for all the others. You shouldn't go by emotions. Well, now we know what emotions are. Man is a self-responsible being. Well, obviously, consciousness has volition. Everything you need to establish about man is just read right off. I mean, the dumbest student, once he got up to here, can write this chapter. It just follows, you see. Whereas, if you try to start with this, it's excruciating. You don't know where to begin. You don't know what to say. You don't know how to prove anything. You just go round and round and chase your tail. That is the structure of the first half of my book, and that's some of the reasoning that went into it. Now, within each chapter, there is the same logical hierarchy. That is, every topic is covered in a certain order, governed by the same idea that you must follow the hierarchical structure. So this is just like the overall, I hope I'm not sounding like Hegel, structures within structures, but this is just the overall, and then within each, the points are developed also in a hierarchical way. And next time, I want to take this chapter, reality, and just go over with you the step-by-step of how I break up the metaphysics from the very first axiom all the way down to the final consequence, and then I figure there's 6 or 8 or 9 units to it. And then I hope that will be clarifying to you with regard to structure and to the issue of proof. So that's the overview today, and we have time now for questions. Now you can... Oh, thank you. I've been assured that there's going to be air conditioning hereafter. Now, this was some kind of aberration. I hope not a structural one. We have microphones on each side if you want to use them, or you can just, you have to wave so I can see you. Yes.
When did it first come to your attention that was not the proper hierarchical order when you were writing your book?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. When did it first come to my attention that I did not have the right order? When I started to do the book, I realized, well, for instance, obviously I could not divide free will between lecture 3 and lecture 6. There was no logic whatever to having half of it and then saying I'll do the rest another time, you know, because now I don't have the excuse that I have to have finished, you know, in 90 minutes or whatever. So I started to do some reorganization, and then it began to occur to me that there has to be a systematic answer to this problem that you have to say everything before everything else. But it's really only when I wrote the part on knowledge as hierarchical, which was since reprinted in the Objectivist Forum, I realized that I wasn't entirely following it, that I still had hangovers of the time when I got everything in one mass from Ayn Rand and hadn't myself gone through the hierarchy. So I reviewed and realized that there were errors and basically reconceived it all. So it's definitely within the... It's very recent, let's put it that way. Yes?
Isn't the order of presentation, though, the best order of presentation, dependent on the context? For example, the order in which John Galt explains objectivism is not precisely the order which you've laid out here.
Yes and no. The order of presentation, you say, does that depend on context? Obviously and definitely. If he is making, John Galt, you quote the example, a speech to the world at large in the context of a novel fiction, he could not possibly go into the nature of concept formation, or if he did, it would be, you know, a quick swipe, like no concept man's forms is valid until it's integrated to the sum of his knowledge, and then he goes on. Obviously, that's... Or if you're talking to a 3 or an 8-year-old, or you're talking to a graduate class that specializes only in the topic of objectivity, so I have to reiterate, I am not here saying anytime anybody, no matter to whom or for what reason, discusses philosophy, they have to follow this order. I am saying, however, this. There is a single, objective, proper order if your goal is to identify the hierarchical structure of knowledge, which is not by any means always or necessarily your goal. But it is a crucial goal, and that's the goal of a technical non-fiction work which is meant to be, you know, a definitive presentation. So from that point of view, there are many options, but there's no option about the proper logical structure. Whatever that is, it would be for everybody. See what I'm saying? Although you could very well say, for this audience, I'm not considering this topic, you know, or for this age group, I'm leaving this out. But I'm saying to adapt the thing, you have to still in your own mind have a clear picture of what does depend on what genetically. And that's why I think it's like an anchor. I'm talking one from each different person. Yes.
Yeah, so I was wondering if you could give an example to concretize that, maybe take a typical child, in other words, and walk through the development of each of those, it would help me integrate.
Well, I'd rather put off giving an example till next time, because I'm going to be giving an example at length of going through one whole thing. And I would, when you get to a child, you have to go very rapidly over some of these stages, which are too complicated. A child, for instance, has to grasp in some terms what a word is, but he would never grasp measurement omission until way later. But he doesn't have to, because that is the automatic part of the process, you see. So don't assume that if you have a child, you know, first month you give them reality, etc. It doesn't... You have to in some terms, but the terms that a child has to go through are not exactly the terms that we presented as an adult structure. But what this really is the full adult statement following the child's order, if that helps you. I'm trying to get different people. Ray, yes.
And for a technical philosophical dissertation, would you have the ante room as the metaphysics of man?
No, why would that be?
If you had a sixth category of philosophy, or how would you?
No, this is a part of epistemology. Well, he wants to know. In fact, as a matter of fact, in the actual book, I'm debating whether to just call it sense perception and volition and not call it anterium at all to avoid that confusion. But what unites them is that they are the conditions of epistemology. So they belong to epistemology. They belong properly to epistemology, these topics, but only as that which you have to know to enter the subject. And then the rest of the subject of epistemology and of ethics is how to use your volition to do justice to your sense perceptions. That's what it comes down to. But they're what you start with. And that's why both of those are axioms, sense perception and volition. They're both the beginnings, you know, in the Aristotelian sense of the first starts without which you can't go on. Phil, one question per shot. Yes.
From these series of lectures, being able to get to the point where we can hear an very abstract idea and then get a quick perceptual feeling of it. Can you elaborate a little bit on why that's important, if one could, versus somebody who could laboriously derive it? Is it just for polemical purposes?
No, I don't think it laboriously. Why should you be able to go right back to reality rather than, quote, laboriously derive a conclusion? Well, I think that's obvious. Laboriously derive means you don't really see it. That's another way of putting it. Laboriously derive means, well, now, let me think of this idea. Seems to me it's connected to this one. Well, I guess I can make a bridge from this to this. Now, if I go from here to there, and from there to here, and there, oh, that reminds me of so-and-so. And after a couple months of that, you finally say, oh, and now I'm back to reality. You could not retain that process, and therefore you have no sense of conviction. All you have, what many people have in regard to philosophy, is not conviction, but memory. In other words, they remember that once they understood it, but they can't retain the understanding. Or they remember that once they saw it, but they can't hold on to that. And therefore, it's not actually part of their mental process. Speed of access to reality is central to understanding. As long as you have to do it laboriously, I'm not saying, you know, you should hold it against yourself. You have to start wherever you start. Took me, God alone knows how long. And I'm still doing learning. But the idea is to get to the stage, if you can, the way Ayn Rand's mind worked, she'd take any idea, and she was back to reality through the steps. And if she had to, quote, be laborious, then that became a fascinating question to her. What is causing the labor? What's the complexity? What, you know, is the link in the chain that's not completely clear? So you want to be able to, you definitely, ideas are means of perceiving reality. In the literal sense, they're means of connecting you to reality. If you have to make fancy constructs and review them and think and torturously holding, you're afraid to move your head because it's going to fall out of your ear, you are not yet in touch with reality on the thing. It has to be right back down. And to me, and the reason I subjected you to this technicality is just having reached that structure is enormously helpful because I can locate now. If a question comes, I know what is its basic presuppositions. You know, where, what framework does it come under? Get someone at the back. I can't see. Yes, whatever.
Is it an oversimplification to say, as a review, that one learns this system linearly but validates through the spiral structure?
No, that is not an oversimplification at all. That sounds very nice to me. You have to learn in a linear way. I don't want to be McLuhan. You can't do everything at once. You have to learn one point, and that makes possible the next point, which makes possible the next. That's the whole idea of structure. But you are right. The validation is the total. You validate each point as you go within the context of what you know at that stage. Then you go to the next point, and that gives you a fuller perspective on the first, And then you go to the next, and that gives you a four on those, which in turn make this one even clearer. And then you could say you validate in the spiral fashion. But the important thing to remember is that the validation is the total. This is the utter hopelessness of the modern method of linguistic analysis, which is that to make philosophy easier, you take any one point and concentrate on just proving that. Their argument is, well, there's so much to philosophy that's so difficult. Instead of trying a whole system, let's just take one point, like cause and effect or whatever, and prove that. It'll be a more modest undertaking, therefore we'll have more hope of success. There's nothing more wrong-headed in the whole world than that approach. Nothing that is actually stupider, because the whole essence of philosophic validation is to see it as part of a total. And by yanking it out of its context, they lead themselves necessarily to skepticism. They can't validate anything, and they say nothing can be known. So this has many implications also of a polemical kind, but I'm leaving that out now. Now, didn't you ask one already?
No. All right. Leonard, in 1983, in the Understanding Objectivism course, you gave a hierarchical structure to objectivism. Does the material that you just presented change your view?
Yes. I gave it in that Understanding Objectivism course an early version, but I now am conscious systematically of the process by which you decide. And therefore, that was a sort of a transition from 76, where I was still of the feeling where you have, in fact, I remember having a fight with Harry Binswanger, who strongly believed volition had to come early. And I was still in those days arguing, well, if you didn't know that reason was valid, how would you ever, you know, define or establish volition, which is just the choice of using your rational faculty? And he finally beat me down. And that was a helpful point, because that helped to connect to the whole idea of the preconditions of epistemology. So I would take definitely with a grain of salt the details of the hierarchy I offered there. What is I'm offering in this book, I would definitely stand by. Till the next... Yeah. Yes.
In your experience, does the child develop and follow this hierarchy exactly, or...
It has to. It has to, in the sense I mean. But that does not mean that the child, you know, spends a couple of years and becomes a master of reality. Then he studies the issue of the senses and free will and learns, you know, about evasion and focus and the different states and so on. Then he goes into concept formation, mathematics, and so on. And then it reaches about 18. And I do not mean it in that way. I mean that in his own level, he has to go through this progression. And as philosophers, we re-go through that same progression, bringing to it the full adult statement. But if you took the child, for instance, in some terms, the child gets the essence of reality. That is the idea. There's something out there that follows certain rules and doesn't bend to my wishes. But in what terms he gets that leaves open how philosophic, how explicit he is. And there's a tremendous amount you can write about that as an adult that will be new information to him, even though on some sense he got what reality is. If you get that on this point, the same is throughout. A child has to grasp what he sees and hears. And he can't go any further till he grasps the data of his senses, and he has to learn that he's relying on what he sees and hears before you can even start to tell him, for instance, what a word is. You try to even give him on the most elementary level, it's not just a sound, it's a sound that stands for a thing, like that you look at, or this that you hear, etc. The only way you could even begin to make words, which are concepts, clear to a child, is through the medium of relating them back to observation, which he therefore has to have access to. And how would you couldn't begin to teach a child, you know, be logical, be objective, etc., which is tremendously difficult, until he's at the point where he's fluent with language, and then he starts putting it together in certain ways. So all of these and he can't come to any real conclusions about human consciousness until he grasps some of these elementary processes. So I would say there is a definite sense in which a child has to go through that structure, but I don't want to mislead you into thinking that, therefore, at each point, he knows all of it. He knows it in the same way that Misran explained he has to know the law of identity in order to go on from there. And he gets it right at the beginning of the law of identity, but after all, how many philosophers don't know it, or have denied it, or whole cultures don't know it? So from that point of view, a child's form of knowledge is very difficult to define. Very difficult, because he has more than you think and less than you think. And it depends how you look at it. I believe our time is up, so we will continue this on Tuesday. Thank you.